From Hong Kong, this is Mea Culpa podcast with lessons learned from startups, based on a postmodern conference where founders, investors, lawyers, and mentors share their stories about working on, with, or for startups. Today, we have Alex Medana. Alex Medana is a fintech guru, if I might say. He's done a lot of things in the fintech industry. He's one of the co-founding members of the and board of directors of the Fintech Association in Hong Kong. He set up different startups, but is also coming originally from the banking industry. Alex, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you today.
Alex, how did you end up in startups?
I think with everything in life, it was an accident. So I spent 16 years in banking. I was always interested by innovation, by platform, trading platform, matching engine, and all of that through my career. And then in 2015, I fell in love with the B word, blockchain. So I was the first one. What I did, I nerded. I read everything I could read at that time, so the Bitcoin white papers and any white paper I could find. And then I quit my job. At that time, I was at Swift nearly a couple of years after 9 years at Deutsche Bank. I quit my job and I set up a consultancy. And I think today we talk about failure. So it's a good start because, I failed very, very quickly. That was amazing because I think I was one of the first in the region. I was in Hong Kong at that time talking about blockchain. And that was before Ethereum smart contracts. So can you imagine how limited the applications and the use case they were at that time? We were talking about, sidechain and multi-chain. But that was very interesting for me because I started to get a voice. I started to build a brand. People were asking me questions around innovations, running workshops and so forth, because I came with 16 years of background, in back office, middle office and trading and all of that. So that's where I started, an accident. And since then, I've never looked back.
An accident. It's okay. You could call it that, but you don't actually, as an accident, quit your job, right? And start your consultancy company. So how did you prepare yourself? What was for you the trigger moment to quit your job at Swift? And what did you have in place to make sure that at least at that point you will be able to, say, pay for your rent or your mortgage for at least a certain amount of time?
I think there's a couple of things. Number one, you need to have a support group, right? And so I was married, my wife was working. So that's if I were able to do whatever I've been able to achieve or fail since then, it's thanks to her. So that's number one. Number two, after 16 years of, trying to innovate, to pushing forward ideas getting nowhere. As you know, entrepreneurs, we have, we are spirited about what we think is right or what we think is wrong, right? And you don't become an entrepreneur. I think you've always been an entrepreneur, but within a corporate setting, you have your limits, you have your limitations. And so it was too much. It was, I guess, boring. It was not going anywhere. And I was on a career path. And then you always look at, okay, but what next? What next? And what next didn't look appealing to me. I had a couple of interviews whilst I was looking and I thought, but it's not appealing because, it's going to be the same and the same and the same. So I thought, here we are. I have an idea. I have 16 years of, knowing what to not do and do with technology, and I want to change the world, right? So use case, back office, middle office. And so that was a drive, an inner drive to say enough is enough of politics, of talking about things without acting. I want to act.
And then usually you hear this story quite often, but then somebody starts a product, right? A company with a product and not a consultancy company. So why did you choose a consultancy company?
So it was interesting. We were a couple of friends and we were talking about trading products, right? So it was back in 2014, if I remember well, 2014, 2015. We were talking about maybe providing algo trading, and that's before cryptocurrency. So, listed equities and so forth, derivatives, that type of asset classes. And then, you know, you are amongst others who are maybe feeling safer than what you are in their corporate job. So they are not as entrepreneur as you. And at some point you say, okay, enough is enough. I can't stand it anymore. I need a catharsis. I need a catalyst to move, to be in movement. And so the easiest thing to do was me as a product, you know. So that was number one. Number two, as I said, it was really, really early. So it was a fact of, you know, talking about problems, discovering the problem, and then trying to act upon them, finding a solution. I met somebody then after setting up, and then I thought that would be the right person because he came from technology. I'm not going to share a name today because on that person because I think it was a scammer. But I fell in love with that person because he was a technologist that I was missing when I was in banking. You know, in banking you have ideas. There's a business analyst puts together your ideas and then they disappear. And then when they come back to you as a product, most likely you're not there anymore or they don't look like your initial idea. So that person, you know, had an understanding of blockchain deeper than me at that time. He was a technologist. And we started to build, I thought, product later on. And then very quickly, it was not so much as building product as just talking. So then I said to myself, enough is enough. Not only I can't make a living out of consultancy. Number two, the banks. Remember 2015, 2016, they didn't have any understanding of blockchain, not even cryptocurrency. So they were really asking me these questions, you know, around is it permission? Is it permissionless? What is the difference between Bitcoin and Ethereum? It was really, really basic. But two things happen or three things happen. One, I started to be known because, you know, I'm out there and I was out there really to build my own brand, which I do less and less. Because I think if I'm invited like today to share some stories, to share some ideas, and if somebody can use what I say, a word or that make them act, so be it. So I like to write, for example, a lot. Second, I met a group of people. We were eight and we were talking about building something for the community from eight. It expanded more or less to 9, 10 with others joining. It became the FinTech Association, which was amazing, by the way. Every Wednesday for a year at 7 o'clock in the morning, on top of our day-to-day jobs, we met and built something from scratch for the community, by the community. And then thirdly, out of the eight people, you know, they became 6, 5, 4, 3. And two others, one Dutch, Marcel van der Vliet, and Florence Spiegel, Austrian, became my co-founder for FinFabric in August 2016. So out of that, I would say failure that I thought I met somebody that could build my dream, you know, of efficiencies. You know, I always think about workflow, right? So how data move from one point to another, how people can be more efficient with technology. And I thought that person would be the one, you know, helping me innovate or productize my ideas. That was not to be. And so out of that, two things happened: the FinTech Association, my participation in it, and FinFabric.
And then from the, I would say, the lack of, maybe the lack of clients in your consultancy and your network, you new things appeared, mm-hmm. new opportunities appeared, and you were able to filter down and then become co-founders with a group of people that you already knew back then. I've seen it also in the past, right? Like, yeah. Especially with new technology, you become the educator of the people that at that point don't know anything about it, but it's very hard to, indeed, what you say, make a living out of that. Mm-hmm. Can you quickly say what FinFabric does or did?
So the idea and in the word, you know, FinFabric with a K, fabric, German for factory, because the idea was to build a factory of solutions underpinned by fabric C, not to do with Hyperledger Fabric, you know, the although we used it, but it was more of an ecosystem, you know, a solution. And ultimately, the vision was to democratize finance, right? So that was the aim. It was really to get somebody. I always take the example of, I'm a taxi driver. I have $100, 100 euros, whatever. You may be a multimillionaire, but ultimately we have the same needs and drive, right? So which is the future, our future and our family. And so that's what I wanted to build. So we did throughout the journey before we got acquired at the end of 2020, we built a brokerage, equity retail brokerage app. We built a cryptocurrency trading platform. And the thing that was the most proudest of was Crosspool, which was a permission private marketplace for private equity and private debt using two types of blockchain, Corda and Hyperledger in D4 identity.
Okay. You said like you had two co-founders. Mm-hmm. How did you arrange it? Because you already knew each other before that, before you became a co-founder. How did you arrange this? Like, did you put like a co-founder agreement together, or just start it? Because quite often, if you already know people kind of like friends, it's quite often indeed very interesting to have them as friends, but maybe not as colleagues.
Yes.
Right. So how did you arrange that, and how were you able to make that work?
So that's very interesting. And I mentioned, you know, one Dutch, one Austrian, and I'm French. So I think we came from different angles in terms of communication. You know, Dutch and Austrian, very, very direct. I'm more on the Latin side. My name is Italian, so that tells you all. I'm maybe more emotional. Everybody is emotional. But I think as well, one point to notice is that we knew each other, but not very deeply and not from too long. So for example, Florian, I met him whilst I was, and he was a mentor at Supercharger, the first Supercharger. And we met and he was wearing interesting clothes. I was wearing my interesting socks. And I think we came from different angle. He was younger than me. We came from very different viewpoints, and we were the only one in the room to have, I would say, if you were to look into it, bizarre or different, right? And so we looked at each other, we had coffees, and then we met. And then Marcel was part of the, I would say, the community who wanted to do something for the wider group of Hong Kong startups and financial institutions. So as I said, we were eight of us. First of all, we talked about what became the FinTech Association, right? So creating a sandbox where data, and Marcel being a technologist, we looked at it from an angle where, you know, we would have a sandbox of data where startup could play with banks. That was really early days, 2014, 15, 16. That was, 2015, 16. And I remember the first conversation where, okay, who's going to do something? With Marcel, that was very easy. He's a tech person, architect, CTO. And then we had conversations between Florian and I where who would be the CEO and the CEO. We had back and forth, and then there was a decision that I would be the leader. But because, you know, there is something around being a leader, by the way. You know, you're not born and in the morning you go, I'm going to lead somebody. That's it. I'm a leader. You know, you can do that when you manage. Being a leader is really, it's really more based on the soft skill, right? But when there's a decision to be made, people have to look up to one person. Although taking the time and coming to that decisions could be a team-based approach, which I believe in, and it's more valuable. Because then if it's to do with one person, you know, we talk about noise and bias and mistakes. So we made the decision to be, you know, COO and me CEO. I don't think we had an agreement in place, but early, but we talked about very early that we would fight, you know, quote unquote. In other words, that we would disagree again. And I don't want to use common places around traits that, you know, a German speaker or a Dutch speaker would have versus a French, but we would have attitudes, opinions, egos, and it was very important from the beginning to talk about it. And you know, since then, I've been mentoring and advising a ton of startups and entrepreneurs. And every time I say, look, you have to separate your friendship, your relationship from the business. I, as I said to you before, I'm very emotional. So I know that I can't bring my emotion to our relationship. Outside, yes. Inside, work, a company, a team, I have to take my emotion out. So if I give feedback and that feedback is as bad as it can be, it's purely based on facts, no emotion. And so that was great. And it was a learning curve for me because I was not used to that.
Yeah, because I can indeed understand that if you're coming from the financial industry, the banking industry, mm-hmm. and then you do like a year of consultancy, and then all of a sudden, you're sure. there in an office. I don't know if you even had an office, and then you have two people that you have to very closely work with, and they're not even paperclips, right? So, mm-hmm. like, what was one of the first things that you did together to make that a thin fabric work?
I think it was realizing that we didn't have any clue about where we were going, number one. We were very open about our strength and our weakness, you know. So, you know, Florian, for example, is an economist. He came from BCG, from wealth. He didn't know much about trading. Marcel and I were deep into trading. What we had an openness, a trust. And I can use the word love, you know, so in a very positive way, which is I'm working with you, I'm working for you. There is something that I'll, again, in my mentoring that I always talk about, it's about being selfish, right? So if I understand your motivation and your incentives, in other words, what success means or what makes you angry or whatever, then I'll know it straight away and I will work with you to make you, to work with you and succeed basically, right? And likewise, and it could be monetary, it could be fame, it could be whatever, but if it's clear that from the beginning we know motivations and incentives, then it's a clear path. So what we did, and I have a picture from that time, we were at Meta, if you remember, you know, and we called ourselves the Three Stooges and a whiteboard. So we had a whiteboard and we started to say, okay, so is it consultancy? Is it technology? We could do this, we could do that. And then we started to talk to people in our network, right? We started to put a website very, very quickly. And at that time, it was in between product building, advising and consulting, right? Project management. And I think what happened is Marcel used to work at a company called InvestLab. InvestLab defaulted, went bankrupt. And we made a bid for the asset, which was a web-based trading platform, an equity retail brokerage platform, which was maybe 70 to 80% built, right? It was really back in 2013, 14, that type of period, really, you know, web-based, particularly in Asia. We made a bid, and I remember this conversation. So I went to a couple of friends, and I said, I need $1 million for that asset. And one said, I think you shouldn't do that because you saddle yourself with debt. And it's not right because then later on, investors, they will not invest in you because you have debt, right? Second, it's not guaranteed that you will be successful. So what I did to, I said to Marcel and Florian, I remember, let's bid as if we don't want it. So in other words, you know, it's so low that, you know, if somebody accepts it, it's fun, it's a joke, and it doesn't cost us a lot. We can afford between the three of us. And then if we buy it, and then nothing happens, then there's not a lot of money that we would have lost. So we won, and we started the journey. So it was maybe a few months after we started to put together Thin Fabric. We had an asset. And the journey, I would say that was very, very interesting. You know, going to retail brokerage firm, it would be a book in itself because they had that amazing system you might have heard of. It's Excel. You know, it's an amazing system where you book trade, CSV. It's at the forefront of any innovation, and they were using that to upload in Terminal if they were lucky or they had another broker, because. And I don't know the situation now post-COVID, but back in the days, you had thousands and thousands of brokers because it's so easy to have a license in Hong Kong that you and I can be a broker and we manage our own money and our friends and family. So that was where we started with an asset that we developed upon.
Okay. Interesting way to indeed
get
an asset.
Luck.
So that means also that there were no other bidders. So that means that you were indeed capable to get it for a price.
Yeah.
So if you look at your co-founder interactions, right? Like you already talked a little bit about, but like, how would you define yourself as a person when it comes to the group dynamics between the three co-founders?
That's interesting because I think it's best for them to talk about me because, you know, I would be the hero in my own story, right? With my bias and all of that. I think it's about listening. It's about having strong views, but not at the risk of, excuse my French, but pissing off others, right? So, and Florian is somebody who is very data driven. So you need to have some data backing it up. Luckily, I have the experience that speaks for itself. I don't want as well to bring my experience to say I've done this, I've done that, I know, because it's pointless, because then it becomes a conversation of ego that I know more than you. And, you know, and it's we are back to school when we were 8 or 9 years old, when I said, well, my dad is stronger than you and yours and so forth. So I think it's really around listening. It's around appreciating what the others brings. And it takes time, right? Sometimes you have to bite your tongue. Sometimes you have to say, oh, actually, I got hurt with this interaction, right? You were too direct for me. And talking about it, talking honestly, and knowing that deep inside, we all care for the same things, right? Remember what I said about motivation? So it's being successful together as a group, even if it means different things for different people, right? So for me, it was a path, it was a journey towards democratizing finance because I thought it would be like changing the world. That was my drive. It was never monetary. Of course, if you become millionaire and you don't have to think about your savings or your mortgage later on, yes, that's a drive. We have it in all of us, but my drive was that. So really it's to that openness, that conversation. And sometimes, the lighthouse, I don't know if you know that story, but the lighthouses in the world, you have three people, right? I don't know if you know. In all lighthouses in the world, you have three people, because in case of an agreement and they kill each other, there's always one that would survive. So that was why. And I always say to people, again, with my mentoring and coaching of entrepreneurs, three can be a crowd. It could be two against one. So you have to be aware of the dynamic. Four is too much of a crowd. It's better to start two, so that it's not just you, yourself, and your bias and your noise. But three, sometimes it was two guys against one, and you have to deal with it up front. Or if you are mature enough to let it go, to let it ride and see where it goes, because it's a learning curve as well. I hope I make sense and I've answered your question, because it's very important.
Yeah, it is indeed very important. And when you started out, was it at that point 30% and somebody else at 10%? Or how was the equity split?
If I remember well, 33. Yeah, it was okay. You know, and we later on, you know, we were having board seats, so, you know, we were four. Marcel, unfortunately, and it was very understandable through his personal situation, because he had just gone through a startup and that failed. So he left us after, I believe, a year. So his involvement was from CTO to less to nothing. And that was something that we had to deal with upfront. So at that time, you know, we had to renegotiate who we were and percentage-wise. Another thing as well, very important, is very early that even if you start 33, 33, 33, you have to keep a portion, let's say 10% to me seems right, for further stuff, you know, the first, I don't know, and maybe it's the first 10, the first 15, or whoever at the very beginning when you are very small. When you get bigger, of course, you can renegotiate that and share some of your profit when you're profitable to your staff. But it's very important that you have some equities very early on for the next people, because ultimately, you as a co-founder, you know, you plow through a path, but you're not the builder. You know, the builders are the people who come in and believe in your story, believe in your vision and in your journey, and are here to share the pain of being, you know, an entrepreneur.
Especially the founders are usually the risk takers, right?
Yeah.
And then afterwards, you need people indeed to build it.
Mm-hmm.
But that also means that I will get back to risk a little bit later on. Mm-hmm. But were you already, like, from the beginning, have like that percentage that everybody had? Was it on a kind of like a cliff investing period, or was it just set in stone? And then basically when one of the co-founders left, you had to indeed, what you said,
yeah,
negotiate. And how did that go?
So straight equity again. So it's interesting, you know, I have conversation nowadays where people, they want me, let's say, to join and build and all of that. And I said, look, I understand there could be options. But I always test them and say, so let's say we talk about, I don't know, 2.5%, 5%, 10%, the percentage doesn't matter. But I test their resolve and say, I want at least 1% straight equity. And, you know, you can escrow it. I don't need to touch it. I can't sell it. You can restrict it. And it's just to understand their mindset. So as co-founder, it was straight equity. Of course, we got diluted later on. In terms of, I would say, getting back some of the equity was tough. And that's between Marcel and I, right? We had to negotiate. There was emotion. There was a lot of things. But I wanted to preserve the company. I wanted to preserve the relationship. And as well, I wanted to tone down any stress for any of us and the company and the others. So there was really, really talking through what it meant, right? And I learned a lot about my patience, my resilience as well, because it was not easy. And I understood him as well. It was, you know, it was as much as his baby as ours, but he was not as involved as it was later as we were, right? So, but
okay.
One very clear message is really don't be an asshole, right? Because it's easy to burn and say, yeah, and swear at each other and destroy everything. But then what you have your pride, you have your ego and nothing else. So it's a lose-lose situation. How about we can win together, right? And maybe you maintain some of your pride because that's what matters to you. And I maintain mine because that's what matters. But it's when there's a company and when there's other people, you have to realize whether you're called CEO or whatever, it's never about you. It's about the company. It's about the brand. It's about others. And so you bite your tongue and you move on quickly.
Yeah. Just quick. Are you still on speaking terms? Do you still each other?
Absolutely.
Or?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
You know, it was tough negotiation. He's Dutch, you know. So, but no, it came from a lot of love and respect. That's what I, you know, if I don't like you, I'm not going to talk to you. I'm not going to waste my time. But, you know, I thought it was important for both of us and the companies and others.
Okay. Getting back to risk,
mm-hmm.
because doing a startup is very risky,
yeah.
right? How do you mitigate risk for yourself? Like, what are your rationales? How do you justify that for yourself?
So, and what I'm about to say, it's really based on, you know, the fact that I had a career before, I had a little bit of savings, my wife was working. I don't believe I have a job, and then in the evening or at the weekend, I'm an entrepreneur. You know, I've tried before. I broke relationships when I was at Deutsche Bank with a couple of friends, and we were talking about building a startups to book massage and straight away. So let's say in the morning, you get up and you have a problem. At that time, and we were talking about 2012, 13, imagine you book a massage straight away, you find, or even a haircut. There was nothing as such. And when I asked about the C word, commitment, we started to have arguments. All I wanted to say was, okay, so I can commit, let's say, an hour a week. Remember what I said about motivation and incentive and commitment as the other things that is very important at the beginning to talk about. So I talked about that. I had an hour, I had a few days I could commit at the weekend. And the others, one in particular, started to argue because it was impacting a social life. And very clearly, I thought, oh, you're the kind of what I call quote unquote social entrepreneur, which I met a lot throughout the years. A social entrepreneur is somebody most likely has a CEO on their card and they go into events and, there's nothing, there's no product. They like to be called CEOs. They like to be senior on LinkedIn and whatever, but they don't build anything, right? And to me, if you are in a startup, so to really answer, you have to go full out. So it's 100% risk. It's fail or make it. It's sink or swim. It's a little bit in a career, right? I was reflecting, preparing for this conversation today. I was reflecting since I've started in banking in 1999. Every time I come in, I know nothing. It's a sink or swim. I'm thrown at a deep end. Now, some people are not like me, right? And some people, they want security. They want to know. They want to be prepared. People like me and maybe it's my dopamine center, my frontal lobe is less developed than others, maybe, but I like risk. It's maybe an adrenaline, but I'm full on or not. I do or I don't. But before I do, I take a lot of time to look at all possibilities. And what I do as well is I look at the worst possibilities, right? Really the worst. Death, cancer, what you name it, horrible. But I don't stay in that mood for long. I look at all the possibilities, all the risk very quickly. And then I say, okay, what worst can happen? Okay, let's start. Because as well, if you don't start, you will never know. And I can't live with regrets or I would have loved to become an entrepreneur. I would have loved to, to do something with Marcel and Florian, but I stayed in my cushy number because then it's fantasy, right? If you are calling yourself an entrepreneur, there's a lot of risk. When I talk to students, MBAs and executive MBAs, I always say, if you want to become an entrepreneur, don't do it. Think twice, because that will have an impact on you, on health, on your wealth. I didn't pay myself a lot of money throughout my journey. I lost as well income that I didn't get. I put money, my savings into the company and without having anything back. So there's a lot of risk. And then physically, the stress, the cortisol, and then your relationship, because you have to push away people, right? To say, sorry, I can't talk to you, Jeff, today. I'm busy, right? Oh yeah, but can you talk to me at the weekend? No. Can we play football? Not today. Not, I don't know. Leave me alone, basically. And so, you can be as well construed as very rude, very direct, because you have so many problems to deal with, particularly at early stage, right? It's not for anybody. It's not for everybody. It's for a few of us, I think.
Quite often, indeed, when it comes to your support team, like your spouse or mm-hmm. your partner or something else, like they have to agree with that, right?
Yes.
So they have to really support, because if you're fighting the battle outside already every day in your startup, you don't want to come home and fight another battle.
Yeah, absolutely. And that relationship is the most critical, whether you're in official relationships or partnerships or whatever, but it's the same as with your co-founder, right? It's communication. I believe in over communication rather than under communication, right? So, and sometimes being there, in your face communicating, it's difficult for all of us, but we need to have some tough conversations. Right. It's needed.
You talked earlier about risk and mm-hmm. you go in it, either you do it or you don't do it. Mm-hmm. usually something happened for people who have that mindset, mm-hmm. right? So is there something in your past or relationship based or something else that made you get that mindset or made you get that narrative for yourself that you're saying always like, I'm doing this or I'm not doing this? Is there something?
Yes, well, there's a lot of things without going too much into Freudian psychology and Jung and all of that, and without taking another hour. I think we are the result of nature, nurture, your circumstances, you know, what you eat, how much you sleep, all of that, how much you train. So it's not one. I think the way I grew up, you know, with my family setup, which was, I think, a poor middle class, but I didn't know any better because, you know, we didn't have any social media. I had food. We didn't go on holidays. I had one pair of jeans, one pair of shoes. So, you know, that I would not call myself a striver, but I was always a curious child, always, you know, trying to find out. I don't like short answers. I want to go deeper. So, and maybe as well, maybe I'm on a spectrum as well. I believe that I have undisclosed ADHD, and you know me, you've seen me. I fiddle a lot, I move a lot. I'm jumping from one idea to another. Blockchain is great for me because you know I believe I have a networked brain. You know, I function like a network. I think as well, being French and failing at school, because as well today it's about failing. You know, mathematics, I don't understand it at all. You know, I speak 3.5 languages. Math is not one of them. I'm very scared. I went to university after 6 months. I thought, what is this about? You know, we're talking about, you know, I did communication because I could not go into the école of journalism school because they wanted a level of math that I didn't have, not even close. So I went to university doing communication, and it was really basic. In France, the first 2 years in universities are very basic. It's like to disappoint you, basically, to make you work hard before you specialize, before you enjoy it. But I didn't know better. And then I was amongst others, people with higher, I would say, socioeconomic background than me. So we talked about different things. I came from the suburb, you know. And so I was very, very, I would say, disappointed. I wanted to see the world. After 6 months, I quit. So imagine. And I always say that, right? So my name is Italian. I hate math. What I have for me, well, I'm white, you know, I'm a male, which helps, you know, I'm conscious about that. But it was a struggle. So I did little jobs. I work in sports shop. I did, you know, I stack up shelf. I was never bitter about the world that I'm going to fight and I'm going to prove. Maybe I started and I've forgotten because, you know, it's 30 years from now. But it was always around, you know, I think there's an opportunity. I think I understand. I want to find out and I want to test myself. I did as well a lot of martial arts, which is as well the fact that you're always disappointed. You know, it's interesting. We talk a lot, and my daughter, you know, she's a teenager. We talk about being good enough. And the other day I talked to her about being not good enough, because for me as a martial artist, it's never good enough, but it's positive because it's striving to get better and be constantly disappointed in a positive way, which is to evolve, to be on a journey. So I think, if I answered without, you know, going into too much detail, because otherwise it could be another podcast. I think, yes, there's something there, backstories and maybe proving myself. That's very important, by the way. I'm very competitive with myself, never with anybody, because, you know, I don't know who you are. I don't know your background. But if we fight or if we compete, I want to get the best out of me, myself. You know, I want to give it all. Whether I win or lose, I don't care. I want to give it all.
Quite often hear that because martial art is a solo sport and, mm-hmm. and those are real fighters. But also you have the people that do a lot of team sports, mm-hmm. right? And then they know that you need a team to to get to a certain result. Yeah. What you say, probably that topic is also a podcast on upon itself to talk about the differences between single sports and team sports.
And I did both, by the way. Sorry to interrupt, but I did both. I did basketball and a lot of martial arts.
you mentor a lot, so you give a lot of advice. But what is, when it comes to startups and entrepreneurship, what is often a given advice that you don't agree with?
So a given advice in general, you mean?
Yes. Yes.
I need to think about it. Well, that's a very interesting question. So first of all, most of the time, I don't understand anything about the product. And by the way I do it is, I'm 5 years old. I have no experience. I don't know anything about finance, trading, blockchain, AI, whatever you name it. And I look at your pitch, your idea, yourself as the first time. I know nothing. So I don't have bias. I turn off the noise in my brain. And then I ask stupid question, you know? I think, I don't know if it's the advice given, but I will turn it around. Most of the time I disagree with is the target market. Well, I've seen some horrible, you know. So we live in a country, there's 100 million people. There's 10% of that, you know, that does whatever we target, and we're going to target 10% of that. And based on what, right? It's easy to understand. It's easy to look at numbers, but they mean nothing. You know, when you look at when you look at polls, when you look at surveys, I always think about the quality of the sample. You know, is there a bias in the sample size? Is there, or the time, or a noise in the time of that sample, right? And we never know. I mean, the statisticians, they will say, yes, you know what, there's no noise, there's no bias. But I always question that. And so when I see a start of the problem where there's 100 million people and we're going to address this by doing that, I'm thinking, okay, you're wrong. I think if I get involved with anything, we have to violently agree on the mission, on the vision, the direction, right? The rest to me are details. But if we don't agree that, let's say, there's a big problem with pollution, with climate change, or that democratizing finance is something that we need to address, or the plight of refugee where they don't have access to finance and so forth. You know, big problems, right? I'm helping a mate. It's early stage. I haven't signed anything, so maybe I'm not going to help him. But on a problem in music where, you know, music producers, the artists are not connected to their fans, you know, there's so many intermediaries. And I'm thinking that problem is so big, I'm interested in it. Right. And you don't have to say, oh, it's billion, it's zillion, it's million. I know it's a problem. I know deep inside, and I want to deal with big problems. I know we heard a lot about that, you know, cure cancer and whatnot. And it's a Silicon Valley spiel. But really, to be in movement, you have to, because everything is an opportunity cost, right? Talking to you today, I'm not talking to somebody else, but I made the decision because it's very important for me to learn, you know, selfishly. I'm learning, I'm hearing myself answering your very interesting questions, and it's part of my journey. So really, it's about something, dealing with something where you care and the problem is big enough. So I think where by the way, if I do a mentoring session on a, let's say on a pitch, usually I say, okay, look, let's say we're going to spend an hour, 20 minutes, you will pitch to me, you know, and I'll be horrible. I'll be like a Simon Cowell. Right? Don't take it personally, but it's better than you're safe with me and I destroy you. The rest, we're going to rebuild that together. So be safe, but I'm going to be horrible. And as well, I'm not very intelligent. I'm not very clever. I will destroy with idiotic questions because I don't understand what you're talking about. And so it's a moral contract that we sign, right? That I'll be horrible. And then after that hour, most likely you'll have holes that you didn't find before, that you didn't know they existed before.
In that sense, I just recently reviewed over 200 applications for an accelerator, and I've
Wow.
Checked every single pitch deck there. I can also fill up probably a whole book about that. So
please, that would be interesting.
Yes. What is the most valuable advice that is ever given to you personally? Like, for instance, like always be closing or something else.
No. So I think that's one advice when I got promoted as a vice president. I was at Deutsche Bank. And, you know, from like having a small team to regional head to being involved with the client strategy. And there was a senior guy, I think he was on the debt side, if I remember, he was an MD. And he said, and I asked him, I said, you know, because it was about quality. It was about the question around, look, how do you make sure you always deliver? How do you like the output? Because I'm always disappointed. Remember what I said? I'm always disappointed. So that's why, by the way, after the recording, I will not listen to what I said because I will be disappointed. I forgot something. I didn't pronounce correctly. My accent is horrible, whatever. I'm always disappointed because I'm a striver. And he said, Alex, you know, you have your senior, you have many years of experience. You've delivered. Yes. Okay, you will always deliver. Maybe not to your satisfactory level of, you know, what you want to, you know, it's not going to be great. It's not going to be perfect, but you will always deliver. And since that day, and it was really early in, I would say 2011, I took that advice to heart. So, you know, I stress, I do, maybe like most of ADHD people, I wait for the last minute, right? I over-prepare. For example, I had interviews with a very large American bank early in 2022. I spent 6 months with them to end up, you know, number one failure, you know, or the number two that didn't get the job. And I read 1,500 pages because then I'm fluent, I'm conversant in things that I already know, by the way, right? It's not about learning, but it's about getting deep into something. So prepare, be disappointed, but you will always deliver. That's the best advice.
That's a great advice.
Thank you.
What's something that's not a secret, but most people don't know about you?
It's not a secret, but I don't know. They know that I'm French. I don't drive. I've never driven in my life. I don't intend to drive. It doesn't interest me because I'm thinking if I drive, I would buy a stupid car and drive fast and maybe kill myself. I'm very, very intense. Since 2017, I do one thing a day, which is, you know, it could be push-up, it could be running, it could be anything. But in the last, 6 years, I've missed my one thing a day twice or three times because I was traveling. I'm very, very intense. I'm very involved. You see me very chatty and all of that, but I don't like chatting. I don't like talking about the weathers. If you see me at an event, come and talk to me, but I won't come and talk to you, except like you, we know each other. So I don't like small talks. I like talks deep, you know, I like philosophy, religion, whatever it's on your mind. You know, when I mentor people, I tell them up front, I'd say it's you manage me, but there's nothing we cannot talk about, right? Nothing. So I'm very open. I'm reading a lot. I don't know much, but I keep on progressing. So I don't know. Maybe I've answered. I'm up there. I'm in your face a little bit. I'm very, you know, very intense.
Okay, that's correct. If there's one thing that you want people to take away from this talk, what would that be?
Well, so, and because we talk about failure, we talk around about failure. There's one thing that's very, very, very tough, but there will be up and down, right? So when you're down, don't get too down. Have a support group. You're not on your own, so reach out. Talk. Failure is a teacher. I don't believe in success to be a teacher. I believe that failure teaches you at least about yourself, you know, where you stand, how you react, whether you're strong or maybe sometimes you can label yourself weak. Don't mind if you label yourself weak. It's not that, it's comparison to anybody else but yourself, how you thought you were and how you really are. You will progress, you will evolve. As I said, if you want to start a company, think twice. Don't start not on your own. Talk. If there's one advice, no matter what, talk to people and strangers, right? So very, very quickly, if you don't mind, there is somebody in Sri Lanka that reached out to me, a young student of law in law. And she reached out to me because what I said on a post, and she wanted me to mentor. And I said, yes, of course, you know. So it's not something that we do every week, every month. She reaches out to me when she has a problem, and I'm listening and I'm trying to play back to her, not trying to unlock and feel good about myself because I know everything. No, it's not that. It's really around unlocking. So reach out to others, with people that you don't have any, I would say, relationship, no emotion with, and progress and share as well. So pay it forward. Always be that. Give first. Never think about, oh, I'm going to get 2.5%, you know, with my advice. I'm going to get 100,000. No, it's not important. What I do, it's never monetary. It's never based on, I'm going to get something out of you. I give you first. So it's not one word. It's like 20, 30, but sorry, that's me.
No, I know you by now. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
I want to thank you for your valuable insights and sharing your lessons learned in startups.
Thank you.
For the listeners, although the rating system of podcasts is hideous, if you like the Mea Culpa series, you can rate this podcast with 5 stars as the motivation for the makers. I want to thank Copy Ventures for making this series possible. If you have any suggestions on potential guests, let us know. Contact details are in the show notes. This is Jeffrey Brewer. I want to thank Alex again, and go out and build something meaningful.
Thank you. I will try.